From what's been said so far, we can see how the likes of Bill Clinton and what's represented by that in terms of the politics of a section of the ruling class, as well as people like Bill Cosby in the service of that, while having differences with, also shares broad unity with, and even in disagreeing, mutually reinforces the dominant political and ideological form of bourgeois rule and bourgeois objectives in the U.S. today. And one of the ways that I want to speak to in terms of the struggle in the ideological realm, including epistemology in particular, and how this relates to the political struggle and our strategic objectives in that struggle, as well as important objectives even short of revolution, comes down to something that I spoke to more fully in the talk Communism and Religion. But I just want to touch on and go into a certain aspect a bit more here. And that's the whole question of, if you want to put it, we could put it this way, certitude versus relativism. I spoke in that talk on Communism and Religion about the relation of certitude in relation to truth and certitude in relation to morality, and I won't go repeat all that here. But one of the points I did emphasize there that I do want to come back to here is the fact that we have a solid core of the ruling class, if you will, at this time, the dominant core of the ruling class, which both at one and the same time promotes relativism in certain forms and certain circumstances, while being absolutist and promoting absolutism in an overall sense. To take the secondary aspect first, as I pointed out elsewhere, they promote relativism at times. And this goes back to the earlier discussion about intelligent design and why should it not be taught in the schools as an alternative explanation to reality. That is, an alternative to reality. There they're promoting a certain amount of relativism to undermine science. In effect, they're saying, and we should understand this is a transitional tactic. This is not the end point of where they're seeking to go. They're saying, well, you know, there are different explanations. There's one explanation, there's one narrative, another narrative. Who's to say that one is right over the other? Let's let people debate this and decide for themselves. So that's a form of promoting relativism as a transitional tactic. And as a means of, at least for the populace as a whole, not for every scientist they would seek to have working for them, to undermine an understanding of how the world really works, particularly as that's concentrated and in a major expression around the question of evolution, but more broadly with regard to the scientific method. It is both evolution in particular and in a concentrated way, and the scientific approach to reality, relying on drawing from reality and, yes, applying rational methods of thinking to synthesize what's learned, what's perceived and observed from interacting with reality, to oppose that with an absolutist worldview based in religious fundamentalism. And along with that, to insist upon a moral absolutism, which goes along with this whole phenomenon that Kevin Phillips describes and others have described as this American exceptionalism of the special covenanted relationship, if you will, of America with God. Ronald Reagan used the term shining city on the hill to characterize this same phenomenon. And therefore, the special goodness of the U.S., not only in its own history, regardless of what that history actually is, and some people generally who are generally a part of and play important roles in this whole fascist phenomenon within the U.S. ruling class, such as David Horowitz, even are trying to justify and even glorify slavery, or at least its effects in the U.S. This is how far they're going in trying to have an absolutist narrative about the U.S., which says that everything it ever did was for the good. Whether or not Horowitz would openly identify that with an obscurantist, darkness-dwelling religious fundamentalism or not, it's all bound up, both politically and in a larger sense, ideologically, with a section of the ruling class that does promote that religious fundamentalist fascism, ideologically and in its political expression. So they have an absolutism epistemologically, which is an attempt to impose a biblical worldview on reality and to specifically attack a methodology, a scientific methodology involving rational thinking that proceeds from reality to draw scientific and rational conclusions about reality. They're specifically attacking that worldview and that method, that approach. Not just communism, but more broadly that scientific outlook and approach. And right now, as represented both in the ruling class and among progressive forces among the population, to use a convenient term, what Michael Lerner would generally describe encompassing all that as the left, is unwilling and incapable of posing any serious challenge to this. Unwilling and incapable in its present form and with its present ideological bent and political stance to oppose this very powerful absolutist solid core, which is absolutist even while at times it makes use tactically of relativism, an absolutist theological Christian fundamentalist worldview and associated political program and objectives for all spheres of society. That's one of the values of this Rabbi Rudin's book, Baptizing America. He discusses how they're going after every sphere of American society. And they're determined not to leave any domain of American society untouched. This is something he gets. With his limitations, he gets this point very clearly. And there's the real value of that in his book. But, you know, if you watch occasionally Bill Maher, I occasionally watch Bill Maher, I noticed when he had Joseph Biden on there. And as someone was pointing out, Biden basically ran the Michael Lerner line on the Christian fascists. It's the elitists in my party, he said, who are basically giving grist to the mill of these people by making fun of religion, in essence. This is one of the people vying for the Democratic Party nomination for president in 2008, by the way. Openly so. He's, I guess, the only one who's openly doing so at this point. Hillary Clinton is in the form of is not. But he's openly is. And along with that, and more importantly than that in a certain sense, because this is, you know, we should understand the configuration within the ruling class and understand the way in which ruling class figures are moving, but more significantly from a strategic standpoint, is how this, to use a certain word, infects progressive forces more broadly in the society who are not part of, even while they may seek to have political net connections with sections of the ruling class, but are not part of that ruling class. And this brings us back once again to the whole phenomenon of postmodernism and relativism. And one of the things I've noticed is in reports that I read is that a number of our people who've had discussions with professors, including ones who are very concerned about what's happening in the country and what it's doing in the world and some of these same phenomena that I've been speaking to in terms of the whole fundamentalist fascist thing going on, have, not without justification, gone on very strong rants, if you will, maybe that's an unkind or unfair word, but very strong speeches, in effect, denouncing postmodernism and its effect on the academia and on students. and, you know, the attendant identity politics. Perhaps they're somewhat one-sided about this, but there's a real and an important point that they are touching on and that we should recognize in a fully correct and scientific way. This whole period now, for decades and for generations of students, in terms of the turnover of college students in particular, has been very strongly influenced by this whole relativism, often in the form of or closely connected to various, you know, variants of postmodernism. The whole notion that there isn't any objective reality, and as I've spoken to before, it's all narratives. And this leaves you completely disarmed ideologically, not only to deal with the world in general, but also in particular in the circumstances of today to deal with what's going on at the core of the ruling class in this country, and therefore what is the way it's moving to carry out things in the country itself, but in the world as a whole, and an interconnection with of those two dimensions. The total lack, if you will, of certitude, or even the denial of the advisability and desirability of certitude, is paralyzing and strangling people in terms of being able to even recognize, let alone stand up against what's going on. The notion that's been widely propagated, particularly in academia, but with much broader influence and effect, that, as people have put it sometimes, even attempting to have an approach of really understanding reality in an all-around way is a negative thing with totalitarian implications. Totalizing is the word that's often used in a very negative way to describe this. As if, when Mao talks about embraces but does not replace, all that were actually being spoken about or applied would be the embrace part, and then that would be a suffocating embrace. That there would be no room for anything that didn't fit into that dogma, that narrative. This goes against what we need to really be striving for and insisting upon ideologically, which is that what matters is the truth, and what we should be going for is the truth, is an actual understanding of reality. Not the competition of different narratives, or not the declaration that there can be nothing more than different narratives, and that to try to go beyond that and get to the essence of reality is itself negative with totalitarian implications. And even when I say the word truth, very many people hearing this, that will bristle with all capital letters and neon illumination, with itself suggesting totalitarian implications. They will associate that with the same way in which these religious fundamentalists talk about truth, and a priori truth, that they do in fact, notwithstanding or along with all their accusations against us, that they do and are in fact attempting to impose on reality and on people. There was that statement in that Ron Suskind article in the New York Times talking about the contrast between faith-based and reality-based communities, as he formulated it, and quoting a Bush official saying, "This is a new era. We're an empire. We create our own reality. And while you are studying it oh so judiciously, we will go out and make further changes and create new reality." And this is all bound up with this absolutist, a priorist, and in particular religious fundamentalist worldview that seeks to impose an idea about reality that has nothing to do with reality or is a negation of reality on reality itself. And many people, the problem is many people see any attempt to counter that with a solid core of a radically different kind as being no better than the same thing. And this is an ideological battle we're going to have to wage very fiercely. Again, not arrogantly, not contemptuously, but very fiercely and even in the correct sense, ferociously, with many progressive people. It corresponds to and in many ways reinforces the position and spontaneous outlook of a lot of people in the petty bourgeoisie. But it seeps down to and has influence among all sections of the population. Any attempt to say there is truth in the world, or put it this way, all attempts to say there is truth in the world are not the same. The scientific method is not the same as the religious fundamentalist method, nor is it merely an alternative narrative. It is actually a means of arriving at the truth. And we have to struggle through with people epistemologically in order to be able to, and as part of building powerful political resistance to what's going on, including the driving out of the Bush regime as a very important concentration of that, including the battle to defend science, including the battle for critical thinking and dissent in academia, and including the all-around struggle, and further beyond that, toward the strategic objectives of revolution and getting over the first great hump, making the first leap to the seizure of power and bringing in onto the stage that whole epic of transition to communism on a world scale. This is a crucial part of doing all that. It's once again, not, you know, it's not like, oh, I hope that doesn't come up. I hope we don't have to get into all that postmodernism stuff. I might have to study up and find out what it's about. Well, this is the work we have to do. Not everybody has to become an expert on postmodernism, but we have to engage this. And some people, there are divisions of labor, some people do have to study it very deeply and then help educate others about what it is and what's wrong with it. So we can wage this struggle in a very determined way and in a very effective way. Because you cannot stand up to what's going on in reality in general and particularly to what's being driven in the form of this absolutist solid core of the ruling class, with all this relativism and the denial that there's such a thing as objective reality and that trying to understand objective reality is going to inevitably land you in some form of utopian, becoming totalitarian attempt to impose your will on the world and in particular on other people and sometimes more specifically on me, as people see it. Now, I've told this story before. I'm someone who's, you know, generally part of our trend was having an argument with a relative, and the relative said, well, you're just like the Catholic Church. You have this dogma and this doctrine, and you just want to impose it on everything. And so the person putting this forward said, yes, but the difference is we're right. Well, that is a difference. But that is not the only or all of a difference. And if you make that the only and all of a difference, then we're not any more right than the Catholic Church. We become effectively what people are accusing us of being. And this has to do with not only political application of solid core with elasticity, but also the epistemological application, in effect. It has to do with embraces but does not replace. It has to do with recognizing that there is a worldview and methodology which enables you to get to the essence of reality and its various forms of matter in motion and to understand the basic dynamics of reality and its changingness, but that you never will have complete and absolute knowledge of everything, and that there will be many things that you won't understand correctly, even through your best application, attempt to apply this worldview and methodology, and that there'll be other things that people who do not take up and apply this methodology and worldview will come to recognize before you do, or even in opposition to what you think. That's the nature of the contradictoriness of this. But to get the richest integration and the richest synthesis of all this does require ultimately and in the final analysis, and not in every immediate instance, the systematic and comprehensive application of this worldview and methodology. That's the whole embraces aspect. But But then there is the whole does not replace. This corresponds to solid core, but with elasticity, in a certain sense, even epistemologically. That you have a basic worldview and methodology, and you have certain things that you understand at a given time on the basis of applying that methodology to be true, and that you can determine with a necessary degree of certitude to be true. But you also know that there are other things that you cannot so determine with the same degree of certitude at any given time. And even that others may have, as I said, arrive at truths about things before you do. Or even in opposition to what you, even applying this world outlook and methodology, may believe to be true at a given time. Because this is not some sort of religious thing that once you get the right formulas down, you can just apply that over any form of reality and it'll automatically lead, you know, almost like a programmed computer, it will lead to the right answer every time. Because your application of it may not be entirely correct, because reality is extremely complex and all the different forms of reality or matter in motion are interconnecting and interpenetrating with each other and altering each other. Because reality in that way and in general is constantly moving and changing. So there can be this apparent dissonance, if you will, that you are setting out the best you can to apply this world outlook and methodology, and someone else is not, and yet they arrive at a truth, even about the things you're both investigating, before or even in some ways in opposition to what you're coming up with. So this is the complexity of it, but that should not lead us to relativism. There is a solid core in this. What is that solid core? It's the embraces point. It's the worldview and methodology which, as such, does correspond to the way the reality actually is and actually moves and changes, but doesn't tell you how that's happening in entirety, first of all, or in every aspect of all the particular forms of matter in motion. And besides that general methodology, there is also a solid core in the sense that there are at a given time things we can determine with a great degree of certitude to be true. And we should stand on those things. And we should act on those things. And we should oppose those things that we know to be not true and or to be harmful to humanity or both. While remaining, and here's where the elasticity also comes in, while remaining open to the idea that even about those things which we can have a high degree of certitude and therefore are acting on, there may be aspects of which we are not correct or even our overall thinking may prove not to be correct, but we still have to act on it. This is a contradictory nature of it, how knowledge is accumulates and develops. If you don't act on what you can determine with a high degree of certitude to be true, you can never learn more about reality. It'll always be catch and catch can, and whatever you learn will never be able to be systematized and synthesized beyond a very partial and low level. But you can't make, here's the point, you need a solid core, but it can't be an absolutist solid core, like the other side at the core of the ruling class. Not only do we have to allow for and encourage ferment politically and intellectually, for all the reasons that I've spoken to previously, but we also have to handle correctly the relationship between solid core and elasticity in our own understanding of reality at a given time. Recognizing what constitutes the solid core in fundamental terms, in terms of world outlook and methodology, although our understanding and application of that will never be quote-unquote perfect and finished, and we will always be learning more about that, what constitutes it as well as how to apply it, and discarding some things and incorporating other things into an ongoing synthesis. Not a closed and final synthesis, but an ongoing synthesis of what's embodied in that worldview and methodology an ongoing synthesis which has enough of a solid core to call it a scientific method and approach. In fact, the most systematic and comprehensive scientific method and approach, but which is open to change, is not closed and absolute. And there's also elasticity in the sense that even those things that we know to be true, let's put it that way, even those things we know to be true and therefore should act upon as true, the things we know to be true and therefore should act upon as true, even with regard to those things, and even while our orientation is toward those things in that way, that is, they are true and we're acting on them, we have to remain open to the possibility that part or perhaps even all of them is not true. And this is what makes it hard. But that is very different than relativism. That is very different than agnosticism that says you can't know anything is really true. All you can know is perhaps certain perceptions, but you can never know the inner essence of reality, the deeper reality that lies beyond perception. Or you can never form valid abstractions from reality that synthesize and concentrate important aspects of what's perceived in reality. Those things are wrong, and that's not what I'm talking about. And you will never be able to oppose epistemologically, ideologically, or politically what is going on and what's being driven by this absolutist fascist core of the U.S. ruling class at this time with that kind of a worldview of agnosticism and relativism. But what I'm emphasizing is, first of all, we have to struggle fiercely, and yes, in the right sense, even ferociously, against relativism and against agnosticism. But we have to oppose it not with dogmatism, not with absolutism epistemologically of our own kind, but with dialectical materialism in the way that I've been speaking to it. And on that basis, we have to go out about and struggle ideologically, and we have to go about struggling politically to change the world and continue learning as we're doing so, and continue to put it that way, refine, to deepen, to further synthesize what we understand both about reality and about the correct approach to reality. So we need, in that sense, embraces but does not replace, and solid core, yes, to go up against this other force that represents the antagonistic interests in society and in the world with its absolutist solid core. We need a powerful, let me put it this way, we need a powerful solid core, epistemologically and ideologically and politically, but not an absolutist solid core. And here I want to bring in, as an aside, a point that's not really an aside, but is a very important point, both of epistemology and these days of political struggle. As part of waging this battle against agnosticism and relativism, in whatever form it comes up, including among the, don't think that these, just because people don't formulate things in terms of, you know, you're going out in a neighborhood or you're working in a sweatshop and masses don't say, by the way, you know, I really believe that the correct way to understand the world is relativism, you know, and agnosticism, and I was reading postmodernist essays, and just because people don't raise it that way doesn't mean they aren't influenced by or don't have their own versions of these worldviews. So this is a struggle we need to engage with people among all strata of the people. And as part of this, as I've said before, we really have to have an orientation. Not that we should be arrogant assholes about this, but I guess in a certain sense we should be assholes about it. We should be firm about it, let me put it that way. That it is not acceptable to have the posture and maintain the attitude of believing something because it makes you feel comfortable, and not believing something because it makes you feel uncomfortable. To put it another way, this is an attitude, an approach, an outlook, and method, if you will, that must be firmly challenged, and including right when it comes up. Like I said, we don't have to be arrogant about it, but we should be very firm about this. Look, I'm sorry, that's not the way the world is. That's not acceptable. If something is true, then you can't stand here and say you choose not to believe it because it makes you uncomfortable. Now, that doesn't mean people are going to agree. Oh, okay. But that's got to be a, that's what I'm trying to say is that's an important part of the epistemological and ideological struggle these days. In certain ways, in certain important ways, especially with progressive people. Let's get down. Let's talk about what's really true. Not what, there are lots of things that I know are true that make me very uncomfortable. The state of the world makes me very uncomfortable. The direction of things in the world and this society makes me very uncomfortable. When you look at this group of monsters that's at the helm of power and has its, literally, not only has its finger in some abstract sense on the nuclear button, but is openly talking about using nuclear weapons. This makes me very uncomfortable and very unhappy. But it doesn't make it untrue. And it doesn't mean that I can simply ignore it because it makes me uncomfortable. And yes, there is a tendency for people who have a more privileged position to be able to have more elasticity, more freedom to ignore uncomfortable truths. But still, we have to struggle over that ideologically and point out what a short-sighted approach that is, among other things. That if the world is really going a certain way, even on that level, let alone for more profound reasons, how comfortable do you think you're going to be for how long? Let alone more fundamental things. So I'm moving toward a conclusion to go back where I started from. In light of what's been said since then, what we're all about is making revolution to change circumstances, and yes, to change people. But we have to, in order to do that, start from a materialist and a dialectical, a true and scientific understanding of the relation between circumstances and people, as I've spoken to it repeatedly, and between matter in general and consciousness in particular as a specific form of matter in motion, and what is the relationship between them. Mao pointed out, as he put it, matter and consciousness can be and constantly are transformed into each other. Now, he didn't mean by this that consciousness doesn't consist of matter and motion in some otherworldly substance or some non-materialist substance. But he was speaking about matter in general and then consciousness as a particular form of matter, which is capable of consciously reacting back upon the rest of matter. And what did he mean, matter and consciousness are constantly transformed the one into the other, can be and constantly are? Well, he meant that matter in various forms, nature, social relations, matter in general, impinge on people, interact with people, with their consciousness, are observed by people, are experienced by people, and this gets reflected not in a positivist one-to-one kind of way, but in a complex way in the thinking of people. What is going on in the material world in various dimensions gets reflected in people's thinking, to put it another way. And then people form concepts. Everybody does this, not just theoreticians. People who work with ideas systematically and work with theory do this on a higher level of abstraction or a more systematic and comprehensive way in terms of formulating abstractions, if you will. But everybody, in one way or another, to one degree or another, forms concepts out of their experience with reality, their interaction with the rest of matter, if you will. Ideas about how matter is, how the world is, what they ought to do about it, how they ought to relate to other people, which are shaped by all these material factors, including social relations, and what's pervade and put out to the people through the superstructure. And then on the basis of those concepts, people in turn set out to change matter, to change the reality that their thinking is reflecting in a complex, not a simple way, not a linear and direct way, but in a complex way and through leaps and syntheses. That reflection in their minds of matter, in that sense, they take back into the world to act in the world. And in so doing, they change matter. They change the world. And the more that people's understanding of matter, of reality, is in line with how reality actually is, and therefore how it's tending and how it can be changed, the more they're able to consciously effect change. Not any way they wish at any time, but on the basis of the contradictions of, and the motion of matter, which could lead to different results, could lead to changes in different ways, not to one. If it could only lead to one change, you could just sit back and watch it or let it happen. And thinking that's the way it would go would be a form of determinism. But people, there's a tremendous role for conscious initiative in changing things. And in the context of more and more bringing your thinking into line with how reality actually is and how it's actually moving and changing, then you will be impelled as well as more enabled to change not only the larger objective world, but your way of relating to it and change yourself in the process. When people see the world a different way, understand the world, we've all experienced this, except for those who were born communists. Everyone who becomes a communist went through this experience. You radically changed yourself as a result of a complex number of factors, but involved in this was your consciousness reacting back upon matter. And this is how circumstances and people get changed, as opposed to incorrect and poisonous theories of human nature in general, and more specifically religious notions, such as the myth of Adam and Eve. Never mind Adam and Steve for now, but Adam and Eve and the fall of mankind and the sinful state of mankind, which means that mankind or human beings in general will always end up acting in a way that's contrary to the good and the right. Or similar notions, religious and otherwise, of some quality of people that is just naturally evil, selfish, and so on. None of those kinds of outlooks can lead to people changing circumstances and changing themselves in a way that's actually in any substantial and qualitative sense in their own interests. But correctly dealing, and first of all, correctly understanding and on that basis correctly dealing with the actual relation between people and their circumstances, between people's objective situation and the subjective factor of their consciousness and values, and on that basis setting out to radically change both in the back and forth between circumstances and people, in the dialectical relationship, that can lead to a qualitative leap through wrenching struggle that is in the interest of the masses of people, and can bring a new society, ultimately a new world, and yes, new people into being through their increasingly conscious and voluntary action themselves, and not by imposition from some tyrannical, totalitarian, utopian force standing above them and in antagonism to them. And this whole process is what Marx referred to when he talked about fitting the masses to rule. You do not fit the masses to rule by taking them off to the side and working on them with some ideological machinery. And then when you've perfected them to a certain state, you can put them back in the struggle and they can make a new world. No, this takes place in the dialectical interplay between their increasingly grasping the essence of reality and changing it and changing themselves more and more consciously in the process. A lot of the masses will say, well, you're talking about people like us running society. I don't know about you, but I'm too fucked up for that. Everybody I know is too fucked up. They're all in this other bullshit. Well, of course. Because you're living in this society, you're being shaped and influenced by it, and you haven't really begun to grasp what's really going on here in any essential way. But through this whole process I'm talking about, you undergo radical change increasingly consciously as you change the objective world and in the dialectical relation back and forth. And in that way, the masses can, do, and will become, quote-unquote, fit to rule, and not only rule, but to continue transforming society toward a whole new world. And this is where the role and responsibility of conscious communist forces comes in, as an advanced force, a vanguard. Not as we're accused by all the various reformists, socialists, and bourgeois democrats of various kinds, and anarchists of various stripes and so on, that we're going to impose ourselves over and substitute ourselves for the masses who are too stupid to understand what's really going on. It's not a new version of Plato's philosopher king that we're talking about. It's an advanced force, a vanguard, which leads the masses by uniting with them in struggle, but also waging struggle with them and bringing to them an understanding through struggle in the ideological realm, while joining with them to carry out the political struggle, particularly around key concentrations of social and world contradictions, brings to them through struggle an understanding of how the world really is and how to understand it systematically with the correct methodology, and enables them to increasingly consciously take up the struggle themselves. But there's no getting around the fact that at any given time, and particularly any given time along the way toward communism, and particularly so while we're still under the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie and living within the dynamics of capitalism and imperialism with all that that implies and involves, there's no getting around the fact that it is not going to be everybody all at once who is going to grasp, even in a qualitative and basic sense, this world outlook and methodology. And to shrink back from that, to adopt the stance of the anarchists or others, that we shouldn't lead the masses, that we shouldn't make a principle out of this division which is objective and real, is simply to act in such a way as to perpetuate not only that division, but much more profound and exploitive and oppressive divisions in the world. To refuse to act once you have this understanding, to refuse or to hold back, to abandon or shirk the responsibility to act on this, in whatever, under whatever banner and whatever guise, even in the name of the masses of people and not lording it over the mass of people, whatever other rationalization comes up, to do that in whatever form, we should face what that means. That means condemning the masses of people and humanity as a whole to the perpetuation of this system and to the carrying forward of what those who now are ruling it in the world are aiming to do, with all the maddening and destructive consequences beyond even the horrific suffering that people have been going through already and for generations and centuries, with all the far-reaching consequences that this will involve for generations at least. It means condemning the masses to that if we abandon or shirk the responsibility to act on the conscious understanding that we've made the basic leap to acquire. And it doesn't matter if you do it in the name of not being elitist and whatever, it amounts to the same thing. It is of no help to the masses, and as I said, it's condemning them to the continuation and even the worsening of the horrors that constitute daily life in a multitude of ways for the overwhelming majority of humanity and chaining humanity as a whole within the confines of this. So this is our responsibility, is to act on the implications of what you make a leap to understanding, and not holding back from doing that. But in fact, if you want to put it in terms of basic orientation, having enough understanding, not just respect in some sort of abstract moral sense. But having a scientific understanding, not an abstract moral, yes, there's a moral dimension, but not an abstract moral sentiment, but a scientific understanding of the capacity of the masses of people to grasp and take this up and to change circumstances and people in a radical way, to change the world and to change themselves in the process, to have a scientific understanding of that and to act on that to enable the masses of people to actually do it in their own interests and in the interests of humanity as a whole.